Well, as we wait to find out what life would look like if Cabinet agrees to loosen lockdown next week, many in the research community say they'd like to see a vastly improved presentation of data from health officials. This so that they can better track COVID-19 elimination. They say it's crucial to provide a distinction between imported cases and therefore who should be safely isolated in supervised quarantine facilities and data transmission within New Zealand that would threaten elimination status. The Prime Minister will announce on Monday whether the country will go to level 2 next week or stay in level 3 for longer. Professor Nick Wilson from the Department of Public Health, University of Otago, Wellington, is our guest first. Nick, good morning.
Hi, Catherine.
What are the issues with the presentation of data right now?
Well, it's just not clear enough, particularly around that issue of transmission within New Zealand. So, as you said, it's quite a different case for travellers who may be infected and very well managed now in isolation. So they're not really a threat to our potential elimination status. But different types of transmission within New Zealand have all sorts of different implications. So, for example, if it's air crew or airport staff who are infected, that has issues for our border control. If it's a healthcare worker who's infected, that has issues for infection control within hospitals, for example. And then it's, if it's just a person with no links in New Zealand who is infected and identified, I mean, that's got very serious implications, potentially reflecting a large cluster. So we're really calling for the Ministry of Health to upgrade its data presentation so it's very clear to all researchers what the situation is and what the threats are, because they vary really widely by the different context. And at the moment, the categorisation is pretty for transmission is pretty limited and actually quite confusing. So we've suggested 10 different ways of categorising the data and time frames for those to be updated regularly.
What can you see now? You're talking about the website, I presume. We're getting the briefings at the moment daily, and we'll often hear, like yesterday, there's two new cases, one linked to an existing cluster. What is it that you see on the website, and what is it that you want to see?
Well, we see a very simple system for classifying transmission, and we're suggesting many more categories that give finer-grained detail on, for example, imported infection, so whether that's a traveller, whether they're in isolation, whether that traveller has infected people in their household or infected people in the wider community, for example, with events and clusters. So all that sort of extra level of detail. Sometimes this information is given at a press conference, but for tracking purposes and for researchers to properly analyse it, we need far more detail. I mean, this COVID-19 pandemic is costing New Zealand billions of dollars a week. We need state-of-the-art systems with everything, with data, with contact tracing. You know, for example, we still don't have digital technologies to speed up contact tracing. And we need to be exploring all the options, such as mask wearing and on public transport and in public indoor settings, to make sure we absolutely succeed with elimination. We're still far behind state-of-the-art practices in quite a wide range of areas.
Why is that?
New Zealand has just not put enough into planning. When you look at those countries that experienced the SARS outbreak in 2003, they learned a lot. They set up more rigorous quarantine systems. They got some of these digital technologies established. And unfortunately, New Zealand has not invested enough in preparations and pandemic planning. You know, late last year, a international group graded New Zealand's pandemic preparedness at only a score of 54 out of 100, then we were way behind Australia, for example. And the ministry didn't take that report seriously and start upgrading its systems.
We're now 7 weeks, coming into 7 weeks, are we not, of quite extreme restrictions, costing what they are costing every day, as you have pointed out. Has there not been time to get some of these things in place? Do you believe they are still not in place?
I mean, there has been good progress, but I don't think we've really made the best use of this time, unfortunately. And as the report recently by Dr. Verrill showed, that our contact tracing systems were still far from adequate. And, the reporting days delays that we described in that blog on improving the data showed, things have improved, but we've still got, we've had very long delays with cases being identified. So there's those things. And, Australia, for example, has a smartphone app rolled out for contact tracing. New Zealand still hasn't got that going. Other countries in Europe are requiring mask use now and on public transport and in shops and so on. Germany, Spain, France, New Zealand still hasn't got a updated strategy around mask wearing, and that would improve our confidence a lot about using public transport and being able to open up our cafes and cinemas and restaurants and shops. It's all going to be much better if you've got that extra level of protection, even with homemade fabric masks. They're still are probably going to help.
The contact tracing, it's been confusing trying to make sense of the capacity. And I just want to stop on that for a moment before we come back to the information reporting. One is the source of the other, right? When we still hear, and the last number I heard from the Director General of Health was an ability to deal with 185 cases a day. And then we hear, look, we can make 5,000 calls. What do these numbers mean? Is 185 cases a day, which would be another outbreak, getting onto the sort of curve we had before lockdown, is that sufficient, given what we've been through, to now open up as much as we believe we should be able to open up? What does that translate to, and how do you get from 185 cases to saying, oh, we can make 5,000 calls or 7,000 calls? How do they marry up?
Well, I think really having contact tracing systems that are highly dependent on the workforce is just too much last century. We have to have digital technologies here, and that's what has been part of the success story for control in South Korea and Taiwan. Yet they were able to trace thousands of people within one day with their particular clusters because of smartphone technology and other digital technologies. So we really need to have these state-of-the-art systems. If level two is, for example, going to allow indoor venues to have 100 people, it's going to be a lot of work doing it by people as contact tracers. Much better to get these digital systems working well. And they will help with other things like measles outbreaks in the future and so on, when they need to be turned on again. So I think we're really just so far behind some of these other countries that we really haven't made good use of the last 2 months.
What do you believe the reluctance is with the contact tracing app? They're not perfect. I think everyone would acknowledge that. They have privacy issues and everyone would acknowledge that. But in Australia, they've hit 20% sign-up already, and 40% is starting to get to the sort of sign-up that makes the thing work, isn't it?
Yes, I think Australia does seem to be making good progress. But, there are other incentives that can be built in. For example, to be an essential worker, maybe it is a requirement for a certain time period to have such an app or other system. Or when you're going into a cinema or a pub or a cafe, you have to show that you've got the tracing app. Because at the moment, if we open up to level two, from what I understand, like a pub owner is going to have to somehow keep a record of all the people going in, which is just really...
Well, some of them are doing it already. They're getting their own QR code set up. They're just going ahead and doing it, despite feeling like they don't have the information they need. Could we come back?
We don't want separate systems. We want one high-quality system that protects privacy and can be turned off entirely after the pandemic risk is effectively zero. So, we should have been getting these things going to allow far more confidence in the new lower alert levels.
Could we talk about the information reporting again? Do you believe the information is there but not being released openly to researchers like yourself, or to the public for that matter, or are there gaps in it? Why is it not being reported in greater detail?
Well, I can't tell what's held by the nursery and DHBs until they start reporting it publicly. Obviously, they have to protect the privacy of individuals, but that can be done. I think the government was wanting to be transparent about the management of this pandemic. And for that transparency to work, you have to have this level of detail, because, as I said, the implications are so different between, saying, infection in a traveller coming into New Zealand, infection in a air crew or airport staff or ship crew. It has different implications. An infected health worker is, that's a different type of problem and failure of the system in terms of, like, personal protective equipment. And then people who are infected by an event is an extremely worrying thing, which would threaten our elimination status. So we need to know all this detail and not just, sort of ad hoc comments at press conferences. We need it documented, and the timeline, last 24 hours, last week, last 28 days, and so on. Researchers are just blind if they don't have this data, and the New Zealand needs all its infectious disease researchers to be able to contribute. It's not just people working in the ministry. We all need to be helping get us back to a more normal society as fast as possible.
Is the information being too tightly controlled, as has been asserted actually by politicians trying to seek information?
Well, I don't know if it's too tightly controlled or people have just not had the time or organisational skills to present it. I mean, the ministry's website has kept getting better and better over recent weeks, but when you compare it to other countries' websites, it's still got gaps. And, we've pointed out that, we want 10 different transmission categories properly described, whereas there's only several at the moment. So I think, we've really got to, everything has to be state-of-the-art to, given the cost of this pandemic. And we just can't have B-grade information systems.
Do we have B-grade information systems, Professor Wilson?
Well, as we've pointed out, there's you just can't interpret some of the data on the ministry website. So that's B-grade or even C-grade, according to me and my colleagues.
Could we look at where we are at now? The original rationale for the extreme lockdown we went into was the fear of the emergency departments and hospitals and the health system being overrun. That has not happened. It has far from happened because of the effort the country has made. Given where we are at now, what weight should this be given when it comes to moving to level two? Patently, it is not an issue. Just answer that first, and then I have a follow-up for you, please. What weight should it be given when the decision is made on Monday?
The decisions for lowering alert levels is a complex mix of health and getting the economy going again. So that is rightly a central government politician decision. But if we're going to really guarantee our elimination status and be able to prove that to Australia so we can get into a trans-Tasman bubble, if that is the goal, and it's probably a very good goal, we just have to do everything at a very high level of quality. So that's great information systems, great contact tracing with digital technologies, and as I was saying, the extra precaution of mask wearing on public transport and public
Here's the thing, though. Did those goalposts move when the goal became elimination, not managing an outbreak so that the health system wouldn't be overwhelmed, but became elimination?
Yes, there has been a shift because the elimination goal has only really been clarified in recent weeks. But it is a goal that makes a lot of sense for an island nation like New Zealand. And so we are not like many European countries that are just trying to suppress things. We are trying to eliminate all transmission of this virus.
Yeah, we appreciate that. We were told that, Professor Wilson, but the thing is, have we shifted to a goal that we are struggling to fulfil for just the reasons you are outlining? We're not achieving the gold standard reporting or tracing or any of the having an app to support any of the things that are needed to fully support the elimination goal. Is that what is being revealed now?
Yes, I think we have got these gaps. We may still get to the goal without addressing these gaps because we've been making good progress, but we don't want to leave things up to chance. We want to be able to, because of the costs of the country are so great, we need to remove all sort of bad luck aspects. We want to progress this in a vigorously scientific, high-quality approach. And we do need better data systems, and we need better contact tracing, and we need backup systems like mask wearing.
When we looked at the original modelling that was done and showed the fatalities that might, modellers concluded would occur if we didn't go into a significant lockdown or take significant measures, have we learnt more about the virus? For example, the prevalence and the death rates in highly concentrated populations versus low population density. Have we learnt more in a way that should see that modelling updated?
Well, it's not so critical to do the updates of the modelling because we actually can just look overseas and see that things can be very bad, especially if health systems are overwhelmed, like in Italy and Spain and New York City. But we can also see if countries have been pretty well organised, they have lowered the death rate, as in places like Germany, but it had much higher ICU capacity than New Zealand. So we're seeing quite a range of different levels of response, but if New Zealand had had what New York City has experienced, it may have had about 8,000 deaths by now. So that would have been a major burden. We have learned a lot about this disease, and we know it's definitely very, very serious, especially for older people. And if you can't keep it out of aged residential care facilities, you can have terrible outbreaks in those settings. Even well-organised countries like Sweden have had those outbreaks.
How confident are you then that the standard of systems that you've outlined this morning will be in place by Monday, bearing in mind the growing anticipation of the country and the growing cost day by day of the restrictions it's been under? How confident are you that you can get what you want by the beginning or by the middle of next week?
Well, I could be very confident that the ministry could dramatically upgrade its website and its data presentation. Maybe the digital technologies for helping contact tracing, maybe, you know, we could quickly learn from Australia, and that might still take a few weeks. And as for things like mask wearing, I think the government could make immediate requirements, for example, mask wearing in public transport, because people can make their own masks. They can use scarves or bandanas, all those sort of very low-tech, easy-to-make things that don't impinge on the supply of masks that you need for healthcare workers.
Why has the message on masks become so strong now? The initial message we got was if you wear them badly, in fact, the Director General of Health made the point, if you're touching them, the outside of them, and then touching your face, you actually risk transmitting virus. If they get too moist over time, they can be a risk for transmitting virus. We've had advice that really they only protect a person who is carrying the virus, protect others from that person. Why are we now having such a strong messaging about masks?
Well, there has been more research that is suggestive that they're helping in places like Hong Kong. And so we've also haven't had the, now that people can see that you can make homemade masks very easily, it doesn't, it gets around the problem of enough masks for healthcare workers, which is absolutely essential. So those issues are less of a concern. And you know, if we look at the, you know, Taiwan experience where mask wearing is compulsory, they've had more days with zero cases than New Zealand have. They'll probably beat us to elimination. So even if masks are only slightly effective, you know, we should learn from these Asian countries that have really made good use of masks and found that they're no particular problem for the population. I mean, if masks were in any way spreading infection, they would have hindered the progress South Korea and Taiwan and some of those other countries have had. So I think there's enough evidence now, and we should definitely try them out for, you know, settings like public transport where it would give people a lot more confidence about going in buses and trains, for example.
Thank you. Professor Nick Wilson from the Department of Public Health, University of Otago, Wellington. Well, as we potentially move to level two next week, potentially, and more mobility, what is the role of antibody testing? Auckland University School of Medicine Professor Des Gorman says diagnostic swabs will only tell you whether a person's infected at that moment, but antibody testing reveals who has been exposed to the virus, even without knowing. He says antibody testing in areas such as Queenstown and South Auckland would give a much deeper knowledge of how COVID-19 has spread in the community and would provide excellent additional data. But Professor Gorman says the idea of antibody testing providing a kind of wellness passport is ludicrous. Professor Gorman, good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
I'm really well, thank you. And thank you for your patience listening in. Explain, please, about the antibody testing, how it works compared with diagnostic testing.
Certainly, can I have the liberty of just commenting on what I've been listening to?
Please.
I'm a clinician, not an epidemiologist, and I come at this from the experience of the last two decades of doing health system audits and reviews, and I'd have to say I agree with every single word that Professor Wilson said. I thought he described the status quo extremely well. So as a non-epidemiologist, but as an active clinician, I have to say I thought that was a very succinct and very accurate description of the status quo.
So are you dissatisfied also with things like the flow of data and the readiness of some of our systems?
Oh, completely. My view is that, by the way, I don't take the perspective of defining levels by what's prohibited. What we should be doing is providing enabling advice and saying, look, if you can meet these guidelines, then you can do things. Let's provide guidelines to enable rather than trying to provide some blueprint of a constraint which has to take into account all sorts of extenuating circumstances, because when you do that, you default the lowest common denominator. Level two requires that the health system protects the community. And to do that, and the most important thing within that, is very rapid contact tracing. And so my view is, if we're not ready for level two, then please tell us why, and please tell us how you're going to fix it and over what time frame. So, no, I agree with the sentiments he expressed entirely.
Are there issues with communication? Are there issues with information flow? Especially now we have moved out of the most acute emergency response phase. People did what they were asked to do, right?
Yes.
And the communication around that was critical. One can understand the need to control messaging. Are we at a point now where that needs to shift?
Absolutely. I think we've... The messaging at the beginning of the level of lockdown was fairly explicit, wasn't it? Go home, stay home. There was a message which we all understood, and I think we have to acknowledge New Zealanders followed up extremely well. The messaging now, in my view, is quite muddled. You can't use words which make sense to epidemiologists, like eliminated, in a community setting when there is a common community understanding of that word, and then be surprised when there's a queue of traffic to Muriwai Beach to go surfing. I mean, if you tell people that you've eliminated a disease, they will understand that given their context. And I think the Professor Wilson's comments about how we're defining data is absolutely on the money. It's being presented in a way which doesn't enable people to find a rationale for rational behaviour. So I think the communication at the moment you'd describe as somewhat muddled.
Let's talk about the antibody testing and why you believe it should be part of managing the situation going forward. Again, with the starting point that we absolutely do not want to end back in lockdowns. What could be its role?
Yes, well, antibody testing will be, in time, a mainstay of how we identify what community prevalence looks like. Antibody testing to date, Catherine's had a bad reputation, largely because a lot of the early products introduced to the marketplace were very poor. They were rubbish. And so there's a level of skepticism about antibody testing because of some of the very early commercial ventures. But some of the most impressive public health systems in the US are rolling them out now. Now, the problem with antibody testing is they have false positives and false negatives. And if you have a community which has almost no infection, then the false negatives mean something, but the false positives probably don't, or the positives probably don't. And so you'd use a positive test as an indication to take a contact history from somebody and to do a symptom inventory, and you'd swab them. So the utility would be, first of all, you'd identify cases you didn't know existed and run their contacts down, but it would start to give you some assurance that the prevalence in a particular community was extremely low. For example, if the test has a 5% false positive rate and you end up finding the prevalence is in that 5% range, then you can say, look, this is showing that the prevalence is within the margin of error of the test. We're not missing a substantive body of disease here. The other advantage of antibody testing, and the reason why a lot of countries are moving to it as quickly as they can, is it doesn't just identify the people who actually have viral RNA in their nasopharynx right now. It gives you some idea of the history of the disease in that particular community. So the answer to the question, will there be antibody testing, is absolutely. Do the tests we have access to us now, do the tests we have access now to have the necessary utility? Probably. Some do. Many don't. So my answer to your question is, I think antibody testing is an inevitable part of how we protect our communities.
How should it be done, though? This isn't a case of going and buying some product from the online or from your pharmacy and, you know, the sort of pocket testing kits. Does it need to be organised and, again, systemic and probably done by health authorities?
Well, I think you've answered your own question. Yes. There was a hope that this, I mean, there was a hope in parts of Europe that you could actually buy these from the pharmacist and self-test like a pregnancy test kit. And the problem with that is that that would leave it them to use it to interpret what the test means. So I think it needs to be part of a systemic surveillance program. And in my view, and again, from a clinician's point of view, what I want to know is what's the prevalence of disease in general? What's the prevalence of disease in people who have gone back to work and are going to the supermarket? And particularly, what's the prevalence of disease for the vulnerable groups and the people interact with them? Because, in fact, as you've seen with our epidemic in New Zealand, that is where the great morbidity and mortality has arisen.
Why is it important that information is made public to researchers, that everything is put out there? How significant is the role of broad expertise and possibly differing opinions on critical data?
Oh, look, I think that's essential. Without any negative comment about the ministry whatsoever, they don't own all the useful minds, all the useful opinions. There is a very strong academic sector which should be recruited to cause. There are some very fine thinkers who can contribute to the debate, and the debate has to take different points of view. If we have groupthink, then we'll end up heading down one particular path, and that's a very dangerous thing in any society. This has to be a whole of country effort at both identifying the way forward and in actually implementing the way forward. Most importantly, I think, Catherine, the community has to understand what they're being asked to do. And if they do understand it, and it's presented to them in a way where they can see the advice has arisen from a robust debate involving everyone with a particular point of view, then they're far more likely to comply. The alternative is what we saw last weekend and the weekend before, where in fact there's just, we have some parts of New Zealand cowering at home, too frightened to leave their bedrooms for fear of infection, and other groups who are behaving as though the epidemic never occurred.
Thank you. Auckland University School of Medicine Professor Des Gorman, and thanks earlier to Professor Nick Wilson from Otago University.